Good morning, brothers and sisters. We're going this morning to think about the wonderful influence that was brought to bear in Moses' life by, in a sense, a most unlikely character, rather like Melchizedek, who comes into the life of Moses and is able to influence Moses. And so I think Jethro was similarly a man who was a God-fearing man who was brought into Moses' life by God in order to develop his character. So in our hymn that we sung about the way in which the future is something we can never anticipate, yet through it God is developing us and shaping us for his kingdom if we're men and women of faith. So I think Moses had to learn through those 40 years in the wilderness that God was still working and preparing him, as I think we'll see. If we go to Exodus chapter 2, we have the account of Moses, you remember, when he was grown up, going to see his brethren and looking on their burdens. And in Exodus chapter 2 verse 11 we see that Moses' motives were good. He wanted to relieve the burden of his brethren from what the Egyptians were doing them, but he takes the course adopted by most people in the world when dealing with situations. He kind of exploits his position of power and influence. But what he learns is, of course, that violence begets violence. Verse 16. Verse 16. In fact, I've jumped ahead. I don't know why I put verse 16 here. But violence does beget violence, and so there was a reaction. He was smiting his Hebrew. He was seen smiting the Hebrew. He smote the Egyptian, hid him in the sand, and then the next day, that's right, verse 13, it should admit it, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to them, what that did the wrong? Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow? So his example had encouraged others to get into a violent situation. Another way in which we can realise how things that we do are noticed by people and can influence the way they behave too. You remember how in Acts chapter 7, Stephen describes Moses as mighty in words and deeds, and power is something which can very easily turn to aggression. He supposed his brethren would understand, but in fact you don't win people by just simply naked power. Hearts and minds have to be won. So it was no good Moses thinking that as an Egyptian prince and with the intelligence, with the education he'd had, with his strength and capability, he was going to be able to be an effective leader of his people. He had to learn something else, and that seems to be why it was that Moses was sent into the wilderness by God. And perhaps sometimes when we find our own lives in the wilderness and things are not going just as we wanted, we have to look for reasons and think, how is God developing me? So it became, as verse 15 tells us, a stranger. He dwelt in the land of Midian. He became a stranger in the land of Midian. And the first thing interesting is he sees, as he sits down by a well, God provides refreshment for him, notice. He sees the priest of Midian's seven daughters coming to draw water, and the shepherds coming and driving them away. So he sees that somebody, people abusing their power and using it in order to get in first and to push these girls away. And so Moses now uses his strength to protect and to serve these women, and as a result of his help he's able to go with them to their home, and it's Reuel, who's Jethro is a bit confused because sometimes it's called Reuel, sometimes Jethro. We're told how Reuel provides hospitality to somebody he thought at first was an Egyptian. And remember how Hebrews talks about entertaining strangers, and this Eastern custom of hospitality is one which we try to replicate in our Christadelphian community. And Moses was content to dwell with him. Again, think of how the Apostle Paul said, I have learnt in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. And so again, we have to, through situations, he's gone into the wilderness like this, God's provided for him, he's ended up in this home, he has to accept the situation and think to himself, God is teaching me something through this, And indeed, he gained a great deal, not least of all, he married Zipporah, and he fathered a son whose name is Gershon. Now, Jethro's name means his abundance. And he's also called Reuel or Raguel, which means a friend of God. And I take it his name indicates to us that he wasn't some kind of a pagan priest. He was a priest of Midian, a strange land. The Midianites were descended from Abraham through Keturah. Later, he's referred to as a Kenite, and we'll come a little later on to reflect upon the Kenites. We mentioned how Melchizedek is another example of an isolated priest who feared God. So I think that he was somebody who God had provided to become a sort of father figure to Moses. We might just reflect, yesterday we were thinking about Amram and Jochebed. We don't know when Jochebed died, but we are told that Amram died at the age of, I think it was 137 if I remember rightly, but I think there's about a 7-year overlap I worked out with the time Moses was in the wilderness. It must have been quite hard for them, assuming they were alive, to see Moses go off and go to a far off place and then to find solace in this person's home. And parents here will recognise that when their own children leave home and go to sometimes very distant parts. And how thankful we are for our own Christadelphian community. If our children have grown up and have built their contacts within the community, then we're always hoping they're going to go away somewhere where there's an ecclesia and where there are brethren and sisters who will provide that same kind of fatherly care. And it's very reassuring to parents to know that's the case. And certainly if we're young people and we go off, we do well to look, to try to place ourselves where there are other God-fearing people who can support us and help us when we're away from the influence of our parents or the immediate influence of our parents. So Moses was to spend 40 years. That's a lot of time, isn't it, in Midian? And during that time, Jethro was in effect preparing Moses, I think, for what was to come in the redemption of Israel from Egypt and their own journey through the wilderness. He learnt that the grass withers in the wilderness, but the word of the Lord stands forever, Isaiah chapter 40 reminds us. He learned to endure. Hebrews chapter 11 says that he endured, he was steadfast, seeing him who is invisible. So that in the situation, he may not have quite understood what was happening, there may have been things he couldn't grasp, as is the case in our own lives, where we're sometimes overwhelmed by circumstances, or God has put us in this situation when we wanted to be in that situation, and we were expecting, think of Moses, expecting to be leading the people out, and yet there's this great delay where he's now put into a kind of, cut out to grass, or into the wilderness, not much grass there for a period of time. That's how it can be for us, and we think, well, what is happening here? What is the purpose of this in terms of my spiritual development? And Moses had to recognize that whatever was happening to him, then the hand of God was at work. And so it's very interesting that Hebrews comments that he endured seeing him who is invisible. If we can do that, if we can think, whatever the situation is, that God is there in some way working his purpose out, then that can be wonderfully reassuring and helpful to us. Above all, I think Jethro was teaching Moses to be a shepherd. Perhaps if we could just look at Isaiah chapter 40 briefly together. Moses is actually described in Isaiah chapter 63 as the shepherd of the flock. And like David, like the Lord Jesus Christ, it was important for him to grasp that the leadership that is the leadership God requires is not the leadership we've been seeing of Saul, who was a driver of his herds. I don't know if you noticed that in yesterday's reading, how he drove his herd. So he was behind them, driving them on. That was the kind of leader Saul was. The kind of leader that God wants is the leader who is from the front, the shepherd, who is by his example showing the way, whose care and consideration is for the flock. And so when in Isaiah chapter 40 you have this lovely picture of comfort and the voice of one crying in the wilderness, and the statement that the grass withers, verse 8, but the flower fades, but the word of God stands forever. In verse 10, behold, the Lord will come with strong hand, and his arm will rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work before him. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. So the one who comes with strong hand, Revised Version says, as a mighty one, with his arm ruling for him, is not one who comes without care and consideration. It's one who has a family that need to be cared for. He gathers the lambs with his arm and carries them in his bosom, and shall gently lead those that are with young. The Septuagint version translates the comfort using the Greek word paraclete, which you'll be familiar of in John chapter 14 when Jesus talks about the comforter. He's using the word parakletos in Greek, and the same Greek root is used in verse 11 where it says, and shall gently lead those that are with young. The Septuagint uses the word verb derived from the noun parakletos in that phrase. So that the gently leading is to do with comfort. And notice that the word comfort, our own English word comfort, is a good word, appropriate word, because it has in it the idea of strength, doesn't it? The fort bit of it, to do with fortification, and the come prefix is to do with. So you're with somebody, strengthening them. So the paraclete is with you, alongside you. That's the idea of the advocate. So it's not a matter of just simply, as it were, soothing somebody. It's not just a matter of making them comfortable in the sense that you're just sitting down in an armchair and they don't have to do anything. It's actually to do with strengthening them, encouraging them, helping them along the way. We said yesterday how Aaron, being alongside Moses, when Moses felt very diffident to go and speak to Pharaoh, gave him the strength. I mean, in fact, we see later how Moses was well able to speak. He was mighty in deed and words. But he needed somebody just to support him. And we can put in that support to you by getting alongside them and giving them not an easy time in the sense that we take away from them their responsibilities, or just simply say, well, don't worry, I'll do it, and then they think, well, I'm hopeless at doing it. We empower them by perhaps coaching them. And effective leadership involves, sometimes we do have to model things, but if we keep modelling them and showing people, then in the end they think, well, I'll let him do it because I'll never learn to do it. So we need to have the right kind of attitude in our leadership, with our children, in the ecclesia, where we're helping people and perhaps breaking things down into easy steps. That's what needs to be done, isn't it? You know, sometimes people are just faced with a task and they don't know where to begin. So if we can just say, well, just start with this little bit first, and then if you do this little bit, and then I'll see how you're getting on. That's how a teacher effectively teaches children, isn't it? And in a sense, we're all children growing up. We need that encouragement. And so Jethro would have taught Moses as a shepherd to have that strength that comes, which is necessary in the work of the shepherd, but it's strength which is directed not into violence or aggression, but into support, encouragement, and comfort. And so Jethro, I think, provided a role model, both because he was married himself and his relationship with his wife, and as a husband and as a father. Yes, and so I mentioned that Amram died 7 years after Moses left Egypt, and the children that Moses had by Zipporah, Gershom means stranger, so because he was in a strange place. But it's interesting when he names Eliezer is named God is my help. He's seeing how God is working in his life in this situation. And Jethro, I think, understood what was going on. When God, the Lord, Yahweh, revealed himself to Moses at the burning bush, that wonderful theophany in which he reveals the significance of his name and the great purpose he has. Moses would have returned to Jethro and explained to Jethro that he was now being called out on this mission. And I think Jethro didn't have any sort of reservation in understanding that this indeed was the purpose of God at work. And in Exodus chapter 4, verse 18, Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said unto him, "Let me go, I pray thee, and return unto my brethren which are in Egypt, and see whether they be yet alive." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." He understood what was required, and he was content to see Moses go now, because I think Jethro knew about the promises to Abraham, he knew about the purpose of God, and he understood that Moses had got to now play a part in taking that purpose forward. We then have this interesting incident a little bit further down in Exodus chapter 4, concerning the fact that Moses' sons had not been circumcised, particularly his firstborn, that is referred to here. And it's a kind of difficult passage, isn't it? Notice the first of all, in verse 22, God says, "Thus saith the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. And I say unto thee, let my son go that he may serve me, and if thou refuse, let him go. Behold, I will slay thy son, even thy firstborn." Now, what's going on here? "And it came to pass in the way that the Lord met him and sought to kill him." So, why was God now seeking to kill? And I think it's not Moses, I think it's the firstborn of Moses. So, why is God seeking to kill Moses' firstborn son, Gershom? "And why does Zipporah then take a sharp stone to cut off the foreskin of her son and cast at his feet and say, surely a bridegroom of blood art thou to me?" And people have had sort of funny ideas about this, and some people have said, well, that's what happens if you marry a wife that's not in the truth, what do you expect? And I don't think it's anything to do with that. We know that circumcision was a requirement. Remember how God revealed that to Abraham. And failure to be circumcised, we read in Genesis 17, leads to people being cut off. So, I'm not sure if you can see that at the back. Can you see it at the back? Okay, good. So, failure to be circumcised, it specifically says, will lead to the descendants of Abraham not being cut off. And you think, well, why was it that Moses had neglected this? Well, we don't know. But what we do know is that God was going to make it clear in the Passover that was to take place, that Moses was going to show to his people, that they had to be circumcised. It was to be kept, Exodus 12 makes quite clear, only by those who were circumcised. And so it was the Passover which enabled Israel, God's firstborn, to live, unlike the firstborn of Egypt. So God is drawing attention to this. Israel is my son, my firstborn. I'm going to slay the firstborn of Egypt. So I think what this is about is that Zipporah, in performing the much needed rite here, is acting as a mediator. And when it says she made the foreskin touch his feet, the margin says, it's interesting, the same word that's used in Exodus chapter 12 verse 22 of striking, the word striking with blood the lintel of the door frame of the door in the Passover ritual. It's exactly the same word, and so there's a very close association in the text here between what Zipporah is now doing and the rite of the Passover. And as a result of her doing that, the angel that would have slain Gershom is stayed. So when she says, "A bridegroom of blood are you because of the circumcision," she's recognising, first of all, the life and death responsibilities of her husband. And Moses is being taught that he has to himself, in his own family, do what God is going to require of Israel, his firstborn. So if Moses has neglected to circumcise his firstborn, then he's not fitted to be a leader to tell Israel later that in the keeping of the Passover their children must be circumcised. Because all that business of circumcision is about the cutting off of the flesh. It's the flesh that's associated with man's potency. So it's to do with demonstrating that it's the hand of God, not the hand of man. It's not in the might and strength of our own masculine or human powers for things. The mighty arm is God's mighty arm, and it expresses itself in God's ways, and it was part of the education of Moses that that should be so. So I hope that's kind of helpful. And if you buy the Christophian CD-ROM, you can search on Bloody Husband and find there's only about four articles ever written. About three of them all just go down the line. This, you know, she called him a bloody husband because she, you know, she was a pagan sort of thing. Missed the point. Then there's a very good article in about 1990 something by Mark Vincent, for the Mark Vincent, where he discovered this view in a Jewish commentary on the Old Testament, and drawing on the idea of this Jewish commentary, he I think gets to the heart of what was going on. So it certainly was a sharp lesson, but a very important one. Now the next time we see Jethro in relation to Moses is when the Exodus has taken place, and after the Battle of Rephidim, and Jethro goes out to meet Moses. Now, I'm pretty confident that Exodus chapter 18 is chronologically out of place just here. And there's various clues in the chapter which in fact suggest that. So just take it from me in the meantime. So I think actually this is happening when they're at Sinai. And when in Deuteronomy chapter 1 verses 6, 9 to 18, Moses reminds the people what's happened, then there are certain kind of connections between the two passages, but it's clear to me that it's taking place much later on, close to Sinai. And when Jethro rejoices with Moses, hearing all that the Lord has done, then he's hearing a lot more than just about the Exodus, although it's placed in here perhaps just to emphasise that. So it wasn't just Jethro that went out, it was Jethro and Zipporah, Gershom and Eleazar, who joined Moses at Mount Sinai. They rejoice in Israel's redemption, we see that in chapter 1, verse 1. And there's a peace offering, verse 12. Remember how the peace offering is a shared meal, a fellowship meal. And it represents a kind of reuniting of the family with Moses, and a kind of reminder of what's going on. Now, we saw in the passage how Jethro's counsel was particularly important, and both next to Deuteronomy and in Numbers 11, this is set forth for us. It was the response to Moses' plea for help. I think it would be helpful if we actually just went to Numbers chapter 11. And notice how Moses is here complaining about the burden. Verse 11, Moses said unto the Lord, wherefore hast thou afflicted thy servant, and wherefore have I not found favour in thy sight, that thou layest the burden of all this people upon me? Have I conceived all this people? Have I begotten them, that thou shouldest say unto me, carry them in thy bosom, as a nursing father beareth the sucking child? Isn't that interesting phrases? You see, that's what he learnt in the wilderness of Midian, wasn't it? The idea of the shepherd carrying the lambs and so forth. So Moses knows that God is saying to him, you've got to have that parental type care. You've got to have the care of the shepherd. But it's hard. It's hard for us. It's much easier to give your children a good hiding and shut them in the room and shut the door and sort of go downstairs, isn't it? Although you may feel bad about it. And I'm not saying there isn't a time to do that. But the actual patience in dealing with difficult people and difficult situations and trying to still look for a way through to care for them and to achieve the best for them does require real energy and spiritual focus and a constant reminder that that's what we're about. And it's understandable that sometimes it gets a bit much. And he says, verse 14, I'm not able to bear all this people alone because it's too heavy for me. The very point that was made in Exodus chapter 18, which is why I think it's part of the same situation. And so God tells him to gather the 70 men of the elders of Israel to him. And again, you can see how it is in parallel with what Jethro was counselling Moses in Exodus chapter 18. There was consideration for Moses' well-being and effectiveness as a leader, and good order brings about peace. We won't go back to Exodus chapter 18 now. We just note in verse 23 of Exodus chapter 18, it's just interesting how at the conclusion of telling him you've got to share out the burden with others, he does actually say, as a result of doing that, then you'll achieve an orderly situation which is good for the ecclesia. If thou shalt do this thing and God command thee so, then thou shalt be able to endure, and all this people shall also go to their place in peace. And I suppose there's a lesson for us, isn't there, in our ecclesial life here, is that we do need to delegate. In fact, you need to do it if you're in business, don't you? If you're trying to run a business, it's no good trying to do it all yourself. You have got to develop people. You've got to coach them. You've got to find ways of teaching them so that they can be empowered to take on aspects of the responsibility, so that it can be shared out and you free yourself from just being the only one who's able to give the right answers. And in ecclesial life it's important. Now I know there'll be people here who are perhaps recalling brethren will sort of hollowly say, would that I could share it out. And there's a lesson for us there, that we ought to be people who are willing to share the burden, who are willing to receive responsibility, to undertake tasks in the ecclesia. But where it's done well in the ecclesia, and where people willingly undertake the burdens, and where those who are appropriate, we think of the qualifications for ecclesial elders and for the other leaders that are described in Timothy and in Titus, then it creates good order, doesn't it, in the ecclesia? And it creates a peaceable attitude. And so Moses did delegate to the elders, and that was a very important process. Verse 17 of Numbers 11, I will take of the Spirit which is upon thee and put it upon them. They shall bear the burden of the people with thee. Thou bear it not thyself alone. Now I think understanding the juxtaposition of this process with what is now described in chapter 12, which yesterday we just passed over, noting how Aaron was sorry about what had happened, is the key to grasping what was going on. Because when when Aaron and Miriam complained, hath the Lord spoken only by Moses, Numbers chapter 12, verse 2, it's clear to me that they who had been in a very influential position were now resenting that responsibility was being devolved to other people. There was quite a bit of envy abroad. In verse 29, Moses has to say, would God that all the people's people were prophets, the Lord had put his Spirit upon them. And Miriam, who yesterday we picked up was described as a prophetess, and I've had one or two discussions with people about precisely what that meant, and I'm not absolutely sure, but I am sure that it meant she had some kind of a status. I think that she would have been a person who, by virtue of her association with Moses, along with Aaron, would have been a person who spoke forth the things of God. Moses, she had access to Moses, and people could talk to her, and she could say, well, this is what you have to do. So I think she was a person with status within the camp of Israel, and that was important to her. Now, what's happened? What's happened is that Jethro and Zipporah, because I think that the reference in chapter 12, verse 1, to Moses' wife is not to a new wife, but to the same wife. The word Ethiopian in the Revised Version is Cushite, and much of Arabia is regarded as the land of Cush and would easily encompass Midian. In Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 7, we get the tents of Cush and the land of Midian mentioned in the same verse in parallel. And it's perfectly possible that Zipporah was dark-skinned, possibly even black. And when Miriam, as can be the case, is resentful about what's happening, she takes it out on Zipporah. Behind it is jealousy, because she's lost some status, and the person, the family that's been responsible for this, Jethro, and no doubt Zipporah as his daughter, was also there counselling Moses, and so she has a go at Zipporah, and it comes through in a kind of resentment about her not being just a straightforward Israelite, a foreigner, and possibly in the fact that she was black as well. Because what's interesting is that her punishment for this attitude of mind was that she was made leprous, white as snow. And is God saying to Miriam, all right, Miriam, then you are now being unpleasant to this woman, and calling her black and other things in a prejudiced kind of a way, whereas actually something else is going on. You're resenting the sharing of power here. He said, if you think that white's the only thing that's important, let's really make you white. If that's the case, then there's a sort of very deep lesson for us. If you just come to Galatians chapter 5, there's a nice sequence of verses where I think the Apostle Paul may well have had this situation in mind. It's in Numbers chapter 12 that the writing states the man Moses was very meek. Now you might say, what kind of a man, if Moses was writing that, what kind of a meek man writes down, I am very meek? But it shows that the hand of God was at work in the writing of this passage, and he had learnt not to lord it over God's heritage. There was also in Numbers chapter 11 sort of illustration of the flesh lusting against the spirit. In fact, when the children of Israel were complaining, that's what was going on. Just quickly refer back, and you stay in Galatians, the people were weeping and complaining about the food that they were having, the generals, we remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt, the cucumbers and the garlics. All of that was going on in their resentment, and God's anger was kindled against them. The people complained, and it displeased the Lord. So there was a conflict here. And then further on, of course, in the giving of the Spirit to the elders and to the others who were to take responsibility, in the sharing of the Spirit of Moses, there was resentment against that by some, which again is the flesh resentful against the sharing of the Spirit that was going on. Now, interestingly, in Galatians, we've got this sort of picture in Galatians chapter 5 of flesh versus Spirit at work. And amongst the lusts of the flesh that are mentioned are jealousy, Galatians chapter 5, verse 20. Idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, sedition, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness. So you've got jealousy right there at the heart of those things. And by contrast, you've got peace, long-suffering, and meekness as a fruit of the Spirit. And so what Paul is saying in verse 25, if we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Let us not be desirous of vain glory, provoking one another, envying one another. That's just what was going on in the minds of Aaron and Miriam, and it came out in a particular form in Miriam's attitude. And in chapter 6, he goes on and says, try to restore in a spirit of meekness those who oppose themselves to you. And so this is what Moses had learnt to do, and what it was necessary for Miriam and Aaron to do as well. And we go on then in Galatians to read about the sharing of burdens. So what had Moses been saying? The burden is too great for me. And God says, well, you need to share the burden. And what is important in ecclesial life is not resentment and jealousy and not wanting other people to have positions, wanting to keep things to oneself and get things the way I want them to be, but what's important is that we should be sharers of burdens. You'll probably know that the first word for burden that's used in verse 2, bear ye one another's burdens, is the Greek word baros, from which we get our word barometer. It means a heavy weight, like the burdens of leadership, things that press down upon us. So those are things that need to be shared. And he says, if a man think himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. So we shouldn't be full of our own importance, saying, well, I don't see why he should be doing that, or that kind of personal wanting me first and not showing consideration for others. What we need to do is to recognise in a spirit of meekness our own faults and not simply be looking to find other people's faults. And so the second word that's used in verse 5, let every man bear his own burden, is a different word. It's the word cargo. Perhaps it's talking about what we might describe as our personal baggage. And we're reminded, going on in the chapter in verse 8, that whatsoever a man sows, he will also reap, either the inheritance of God's kingdom, eternal life, or corruption. Shall of the flesh reap corruption? Is that an allusion to the corrupting symbol of leprosy that Miriam was afflicted with? But he that soweth to the Spirit shall the Spirit reap life everlasting. So I think there's a few very interesting echoes in Galatians 5 and 6 there to this particular situation, and certainly the pattern is there, which we can fit into it. And we're reminded, of course, of the Good Shepherd, the Lord Jesus Christ, the one who says, come unto me, all ye that labour and are heavy laden. Using the word 40 on there, the baggage, we're laden down with our baggage, and I will give you rest. So, the promised land, that's the rest, isn't it, to which Moses is leading the people. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek. There's the meekness that Moses had learnt about in his education as a shepherd under the direction of Jethro. And lowly in heart, ye shall find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. So we need to be people who share one another's burdens. We need to be reassured that the Good Shepherd, the one who gently leads, Isaiah chapter 40 verse 11, is the Lord himself, and he will be alongside us to comfort and strengthen us through our burdens and to help us forward. And as we're influenced by his example as he leads us, so we must try and replicate that example in our relationships with others. Moving on, Moses tries to encourage the family of Jethro to accompany them as they leave Sinai to head off in the direction of the promised land. And in Numbers chapter 10, verse 29, Moses says unto Hobab, the son of Raguel, so this is Jethro, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, "We're journeying into the place of which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come thou with us, and we will do thee good. For the Lord hath spoken good concerning Israel." And at first it's clear he doesn't want, "I will not go," he says, "I will depart to mine own land and my kindred." And Moses urges him, "Leave us not, I pray thee. It shall be, if thou go with us, yea, it shall be that what goodness the Lord shall do unto us, the Lord will do unto thee." And it isn't quite clear at that point what happens. But what we do learn is that a little later on, there's evidence that they did go. And so whatever kind of lingering doubts Hobab had between staying with what was familiar to him and going forward into the unknown, he perhaps realized that he must trust in God, as we have to trust in God as we go forward in our lives. When we come to Judges chapter 1 in verse 16, sequence of passages here I'd like to bring you to, we have a reference to the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law. The Revised Version says brother-in-law, going up out of the city of palm trees with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah. So it seems that Hobab did go, and for all we know, other members of Jethro's family. And we pick up here too that they are to be described as Kenites. And you may remember in Numbers chapter 24, Balaam prophesies of the Kenites. Strong is thy, it says Canaanites in the authorized version, but it should be Kenites. The prophecy is, "Strong is thy dwelling place, thou puttest thy nest," the word Hebrew word is ken, "in a rock." So it's interesting how Balaam, in the midst of his prophecies, focuses in on the strength of the Kenites. And you'll remember too, in Judges chapter 4, I'm sure, that Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, was the one who killed Sisera, the enemy of Israel, and is commended by Deborah for his act of faith. So the Kenites become people who are very significant in the life of Israel. Again, in Samuel, Saul spares the Kenites, 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 6, "For ye showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came out of Egypt." And in the 1st of Chronicles, chapter 2, verse 55, Hemath, his name means fortress, is a God-fearing Kenite and is described as the father of the house of Rechab. Now, isn't that interesting? So we've now got a link between Jethro and his family, the Kenites and their role in Israel's history, and now the Rechabites. There are a number of situations involving the Rechabites which crop up in Scripture. In the 2 Kings chapter 10, verses 15 to 17, Jonathan, the son of Rechab, assists Jehu in the work that God has caused Jehu to commence and to carry out in Israel. And above all, you'll remember in Jeremiah chapter 35 how the Rechabites are commended for their outstanding faith, that they have kept the promises of their father. Let's just turn to Jeremiah chapter 35 and remind ourselves. Verse 6, they say, "We will Drink no wine, for Jonadab the son of Rechab our father commanded us, saying, shall drink no wine, neither ye nor your sons forever. It's a kind of Nazarite type vow that they'd undertaken. All your days ye shall dwell in tents. And maybe this was harping back to the nomadic life of their forefather Jethro, and association with the journey, and what was to be learnt in that journey. Verse 8, thus have we obeyed the voice of Jonadab the son of Rechab, our father, in all that he has charged us, to drink no wine all our days, we or our wife, nor to build houses, neither have we vineyard, nor field, nor seed, but we have dwelt in tents and have obeyed, and done according to all that Jonadab our fathers commanded us. And in verse 18, Jeremiah said unto the house of Rechabites, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, ye, because ye have obeyed the commandment of Jonadab, and have done according to all that he commanded you, therefore thus saith the Lord of hosts, Jonadab the son of Rechab shall not want a man to stand before me forever. And so you see there's a contrast that Jeremiah draws between their faithfulness to their father's commandment and the faithlessness of the children of Israel. He says, I've spoken, verse 14, I've spoken unto you rising early and speaking, but ye hearken not unto me. And so it seems to me that that outstanding faith of Jethro, which was so important in the 40 years of Moses' development in the wilderness of Midian, as he learnt the work of the leadership of the shepherd, the advice and counsel that Jethro was then to give him about sharing the burden with the people and the things that had to be learnt from that, the help that was then provided by his family as they went on the wilderness journey through to the promised land, and the faithfulness of other succeeding members of the family who showed that they were always on the Lord's side to carry out his will, demonstrates to us the way in which the influence of somebody can be very profound, not just in one generation, but in succeeding generations too. And so just to summing up what we've learnt this morning, Jethro was a God-fearing priest, like Melchizedek, a shadowy figure who comes from nowhere. The action of Zipporah was a faithful action in the circumcision of Gershom, although it should have been done earlier, and they are assisting Moses in a faithful way in his role as leader. They provided training and example during the 40 years and found opportunity to guide and counsel him during the next 40 years of his wilderness journey. And we saw finally how his descendants, the Kenites and the Rechabites, were models of faithful continuance in well-being, in well-doing. If we, brothers and sisters, can allow the influence of faithful men to be in our lives, then we too can be encouraged in the same faithful continuance in well-doing.